Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Slate Money is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every method with one simple integration. Plus, we'll give you your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/SlateMoney. And by ZipRecruiter. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 job sites with a single click and an interface that's easy to use. And right now, you can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/SlateMoney. That's ZipRecruiter.com/SlateMoney. And by The Message, an original science fiction podcast from Panoply and GE Podcast Theater. All of Season 1 is available now, so listen and find out why a 70-year-old alien recording seems to be killing people. Search for The Message on iTunes.
I'm Gretchen Rubin.
And I'm Elizabeth Kraft, her sister and happiness guinea pig.
Every week on our podcast, we talk about a try this at home tip for making your life happier. Which try this at home tip do you think listeners have most responded to?
Without question, the 1 minute rule.
Oh, the rule that anything that you can do in less than a minute, you do without delay.
Yes, put a dish in a dishwasher, hang up a coat, whatever. I have to say, this has improved my marriage because my husband is neat and I'm not.
And this is a good example of that happiness can feel very transcendent and abstract, but sometimes it's the little practical things that give us the biggest happiness boost. Search for Happier wherever you find your podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Mega Merger edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week, or possibly the year. I don't know. I feel that this year has been a big year for something we don't talk about all that much, seeing as how this is a business and finance show, which is corporate finance, mergers and acquisitions. So we're going to devote this entire episode to, I promise it's not as boring as it sounds, or at least it won't be, because we have Kathy O'Neill, the data scientist and blogger at mathbabe.org.
Hello.
Hello, Kathy. And even more excitingly, we don't have the Slate resident millennial, Jordan Weissman, who's staycating right now. And instead, we have
probably eating a McDonald's every morning.
And probably having a McGriddle as we speak. We are very blessed to be joined by the one and only Jim Ledbetter, who runs Inc. magazine and also hosts an awesome Panoply podcast called
Inc. Uncensored. And no truth to the rumor that we're merging with Slate Money.
But is there truth to the rumor that you're in talks with Atlantic Media?
We're in play.
Quartz?
We're in. Yeah, our podcast is in play.
The podcast is in play. Everyone is in play. It's a big like media gossip day today. There's newspapers being bought in Nevada
and in
China. Hong Kong and also Quartz is apparently up for sale.
Really?
That's what the
FT
is reporting.
That goes perfectly with our theme.
I did not see that.
Yeah.
Who would buy Quartz?
Axel Springer.
Right.
Maybe. Or any number of people.
Is there a price tag associated with it?
No, there isn't. But they said the revenues are now $15 million. So if you take the standard new media multiple of, what, 6-7 times, it's like $100
million-ish. Yeah, interesting.
What do you think? Kathy, would you pay $100 million for Quartz?
It's hard to imagine having $100 million. Let me think about that.
If you had $100 million, would you spend it on a website?
No.
No.
Turns out that's easy.
So if you had $13.9 billion dollars, Kathy, what would you spend it on?
I would spend it on a coffee company called Keurig. And I would be a very rich German family. Topic one is the merger, is the acquisition of Keurig Green Mountain by JAB Holding Company.
For how much?
For $13.9 billion.
That's a lot of money. Okay. So this week I saw something which I've never seen before, and I thought this is something we need to talk about on the podcast, which is the phrase coffee platform.
Oh, is that what the Keurig K-Cup situation is called?
Well, it's no. Well, it's the acquirer is building out a global coffee platform.
Oh, yes,
platform.
They are. Listen to me. This is called the JAB Group Holding Company. It's basically just a very, very rich German family I don't know anything about. Maybe you do, Felix. We could talk about the family. But they, in the last 3 years, have acquired a bunch of coffee companies. So they've acquired, some of them I don't know, Masters Blenders, DE Masters Blenders, Jacobs Douwer Egberts, Caribou Coffee Company,
sure.
Pete's Coffee and Tea, we might have heard of, Stumptown Coffee Roasters,
sure.
And Intelligentsia Coffee, which I've never heard of.
Oh, no.
Oh, Intelligentsia. You haven't heard of Intelligentsia?
No.
Intelligentsia is like if you're... So I am of the opinion, and I can't repeat this often enough, and I completely agree with Tyler Cowen on this one, who I think I stole it from, that there is no such thing as too many hipster coffee shops. The hipster coffee shops are always and everywhere a good thing. And Intelligentsia is a hipster coffee shop, just like Blue Bottle, just like Stumptown, just like all of the other ones. And they make good coffee, just like La Colombe. And the more we have of those, the better.
I kind of agree. I mean, just on like 14th and 15th, between on 6th Avenue between 14th and 15th, there's like Fika and Think Coffee. And we need both of them because the line at Fika sometimes gets kind of long.
But
so
by
just
contrast, there can be too many Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. Is that a correct corollary?
Yes, absolutely. And there's been an ongoing slate money debate about Starbucks, which is a kind of sub-debate of the McDonald's debate.
Right.
And and my theory about Starbucks is that it was helpful in bringing up the minimum quality of American quality of American coffee.
British, too, by the way.
Starbucks is bad coffee.
Yeah.
But at least it made people realize just how bad even worse coffee was.
That's right.
Okay, so let's talk about bad coffee. Because the thing about this coffee platform that JAB is setting up, and we'll talk about Keurig, too, because it's an interesting company in itself. But they're trying to compete with Nestle, which is like...
Which is Nespresso.
Yeah, Nespresso, and it's
and
huge in
Nescafe,
Europe.
Nescafe, yeah.
Yeah, and also a lot of instant coffee.
No, exactly. Nescafe is really bad coffee. Yeah. Like, when I was growing up in England...
That's what I'm saying.
Coffee was instant coffee.
Still, in parts of England, if you order a coffee, the default will be instant coffee.
But
because why aren't you ordering tea? Because you haven't ordered tea, we're going to give you this crap.
And one of the things that I grew up with was television ads for instant coffee. It was one of the most advertised things on the telly was ads for instant coffee, and the ads for instant coffee were always, "This tastes just as good as if you'd brewed it."
So the funny thing about
Felix
it is,
Felix never has a second cup at home.
Let's stick with instant coffee for a second. The play that I think that they're trying to make here with buying up all these coffee companies is just to have this huge coffee network. But it's the growth in coffee isn't so much in this country or in Europe even. It's in the emerging markets. So like, for example, I went to Ghana a few years ago and not many people drank coffee, but people were starting to drink coffee. And the only available coffee was instant coffee. So I think that is where they're really trying. And believe it, I mean, it's like Western Africa, they don't drink coffee. In Eastern Africa, they make coffee, but it's this weird thing.
So I want to ask you about this acquisition of Keurig Green Mountain, which makes those horrible sort of coffee capsule machines,
pods
in K-cups. Which you find only in like bad offices because
hotels.
No one in
hotel
hotels. Rooms. And I just thought that the world had moved on because people realized how bad that coffee is and they've either started making good coffee or at least bought an espresso machine or something.
It's not the method, is it? It's the quality of the coffee in the pod. Presumably, if you had decent coffee in the pod, it could make you a decent cup
guys,
of coffee.
Guys, I want to remind you of something. And I feel like Jordan over here talking about McDonald's, but do you remember how bad the coffee in offices was before K-Cups?
Yeah.
It was like a pot of coffee made God knows when. and it was like 6 hours later, and you finally found it.
Oh, wait, are you talking about Slate?
Mr. Coffee. It's burning at the bottom.
It's burnt.
It's kind of burnt
at the bottom. It's thick. Yeah. It's like a spoon wouldn't be able to stir it.
Yeah.
The K-cups were actually kind of a big deal,
absolutely,
and it was a good step forward. And the great thing about K-cups, and I'll say all the positive things before I demolish it because I hate K-cups. The good thing about it is that any individual would be able to use it, and like they wouldn't have to clean up anything.
Right.
The main thing is like real coffee requires maintenance, and nobody in a coffee office is willing to do
that. And there's a whole thing of coffee grounds which you need to deal
with,
and no one likes to
deal
with coffee grounds.
They took care of that.
And this is where capsules were a very, very fast-growing part of the coffee world. And K-cups are the biggest capsule platform in America.
There's that word again.
And Nespresso pods, which are vastly superior, are the biggest capsule platform in the world. And so now there's this huge fight between JAB and its platform and Nestle and its platform as to who's going to win the
This
capsule
is like the
wars.
AOL Yahoo instant messaging battle of the early aughts.
So one of the things that they did that pissed people off, and I think one of the reasons that Keurig was actually going down, its stock was going down until it just bought, which brought it way back up, was that they made these machines called Keurig 2.0 machines, and the machines would refuse to allow generic K-cups.
Wow.
To be inserted. They had this little test to make sure it was a Keurig certified cup. And all these generic
digital rights management for coffee.
Exactly what it was. It's just like the Kindle, you couldn't export your Kindle books to other readers. You couldn't, use generic cups and K-cups. People got pissed off by this, and they actually reintroduced the old version where you're allowed to use generic cups. But this was a big problem. And sales went way down for the machines, but the sales went way up for the cups. So in some sense, they did it in a smart way. They're just like, we know people, once they have these machines, have to buy the cups that go along with them. It's awful.
And it's the razors and the razor blade strategy. But it seemed to, it's a strategy which works until
what does
it
that
doesn't.
Mean? Razor, razor blade.
Give the razor away for free and sell you the blades.
Oh. Right?
Is
that true for like men's razors?
It was. Now they charge you a lot for the razor. But in the old days.
But they still make the real money on the blades. No one actually makes money selling razors.
It does seem crazy how expensive razor blades are.
It's a separate conversation.
Well, yeah, a certain Slate Money sponsor who's not sponsoring us this week, so we're not going to talk about them, is trying to disrupt that business. So the question which I have for you, Kathy, is $13.9 billion. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, they bought it at basically $92 a share, which was almost twice what they were selling, the shares were selling at a week ago. So the question is, why did JAB Holdings pay too much for it, or pay so much for it?
Yes, and what's the answer?
I don't really have a theory about that.
Jim?
So let's guess and or stipulate that consumers don't care, right? The brands matter. Arguably, there are Pete's fans, there are Stumptown fans, but they don't really care who signs the checks. We agree that that's almost certainly the case. Then I can only assume it's efficiencies from economies of scale, right? That somehow the distribution networks can be streamlined.
I'm sure that there's an argument that it's worth it to them much to pay that much. But why didn't they just get to pay less than that? Like, why did Keurig hold out for that price? I don't understand why they didn't get a little bit less.
Well, I think the way that M&A works is if you want to take over a public company, you generally need to pay a significant premium to the stock price. You can't just like go in and pay 10% more and the board of directors go, oh, okay.
Why is that?
Because you're losing the optionality, right? If you're traded on the stock market, there's a huge option value to holding the stock and possibly seeing it go up. So you lose all of that option value by selling. It's just, you're just collapsing.
If you are a director.
If you're a director, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they hold out.
So, yeah, most takeovers of public companies, it's very common to see 50, 75% premiums to, where the stock price was, especially in the case of a company like Keurig, where the stock price was actually in the hundreds not that long ago.
Right.
So it's like, it's not unthinkable. In the relatively recent past, it was worth this much. And so why should we care too much about what it was worth yesterday?
So are we thinking like their owners, they have lots of stocks in this company whose value is quite variable. And when they get bought, they lose that variability. It's just a stuck number at that point.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And variability has
value. Somehow it gets made up for by the very large check that ends up in their pocket.
That's it for coffee. I need to thank Braintree for sponsoring us this week because they're awesome. It's a beautiful thing when your customers want to pay you, but what if they could pay in a million different ways? Well, maybe not a million, but Braintree lets you accept every conceivable form of payment, including Apple Pay, PayPal, Android Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, you name it. You can take them all in, get this, 130 different currencies. You're not even constrained to the dollar anymore. As your company grows, Braintree will be there as the conduit for all of the money that's coming in. It's a great little thing. It just takes a couple of lines of code to get started. To learn more, visit braintreepayments.com/money. All right, so topic two is...
Yahoo!
Oh, my God.
So this is one. This is a fascinating story to me because I feel that people love to talk about Yahoo because it's this massive company we all know, and it almost everyone in America visits some kind of Yahoo site at some point over the course of the month. And
Stop right there. Like what?
You look at Yahoo Finance.
Yeah, Yahoo Finance is
actually probably every day.
Okay. Besides people in finance who all look at Yahoo Finance.
Yahoo Sports is enormous.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Yahoo Mail is huge. And there's just other whole swathes of bits and pieces. The Yahoo homepage still gets 200 million visitors a day or something. It's absolutely enormous. And so people think about it as a internet business, which has traffic, which sells ads, which has apps, which buys, you know, smaller internet businesses like Tumblr or, you know, little
Flickr.
News apps and Flickr, yeah.
Delicious. Didn't they buy Delicious?
They did buy Delicious. Do you remember Delicious?
I don't even, what is that?
Delicious was the tagging post search site. It was just way too complicated, but there was this idea that we would find things on the internet through kind of consensual tagging rather than search per se.
Oh.
And it might have worked, but no one really knew how to use it.
And also no one knew where to put the dots.
Yeah,
it was a mess. del.icio.us.
So you could say, oh, my friend was here and they liked this
something
product.
Like that. Everyone agrees that this is the best entry about Chelsea or whatever.
Oh,
and that's how we would come to find content on the internet.
There was a lot of talk in the late 90s about ontology.
Yeah.
And all that kind of went away with
Google.
Search.
Yeah.
But there was a time when everyone was really trying to solve the ontology problem on the internet, and that was part of it. But
anyway,
the fact is that for all that Yahoo does various bits and pieces of things on the internet at quite astonishing scale, if you look at the company called Yahoo, it's worth gazillions of dollars. So it's worth about $30 billion or $35 billion. And what people love to do is they love to do these things called sum of the parts valuations.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim and I used to work at Reuters next to the people at Breaking Views. And as far as I can make out, that's all that Breaking Views ever does. Is these like so they look at a company and say, well, this bit is worth this much and this bit is worth that much. And so the whole company is undervalued or overvalued. And Yahoo is the classic company you can do this with because it owns a very large stake in Alibaba. And
right.
Alibaba is a listed company, which you know how much that stake is worth to like the penny. It also owns a very large stake in Yahoo Japan, and Yahoo Japan is also a listed company. You know how much that stake is worth. And if you add up the Alibaba stake and the Yahoo Japan stake, and then that number comes to more than the market capitalization of Yahoo. And so people are saying...
Therefore, buy.
So people are saying, well, how do we unlock this value?
And Yahoo unlock the value.
Had an idea.
Can I go back for 1 second? I'm kind of all over the place today, but... You know how we just talked about how JAB Holdings overpaid in a certain way? They paid
right.
more. Doesn't that kind of fly in the face of this breakdown by
yes.
by value?
Yes and no.
Because we're saying it's like you buy a bunch of things in your basket.
The beauty of
you paid too much.
The beauty of the free market, one of the beauties of the free market is there is no fixed right way to organize a company, to structure a company, right? I mean, we've gone through over the decades trends in conglomerates, trends toward breaking up conglomerates. I mean, Felix, you say Yahoo is a good example of this. Actually, I mean, Yahoo's like an extreme example of this. In fact, Yahoo doesn't even really make sense anymore as a unified company. It is more like a receptacle into which a bunch of things have been dumped. So the plan was to sell the Alibaba stake.
So the plan was to spin off the Alibaba stake and give it to shareholders as a separate company called Abco. Mm. And
for Alibaba Company. This is the good creative things.
And so to sell it to Americans, though.
Just to spin off. So whoever owns Yahoo's shares
right.
would henceforth have
some
Yahoo
fraction
shares.
Of Abco
and
shares.
Also, you'd have, like, for every Yahoo share, you would also have an Abco share.
Okay.
And then the Abco share is basically just a holding company which does nothing but hold a bunch of Alibaba stock and wait for the fateful day that Alibaba finally gets around to buying it. But, yeah, so the IRS refused to say that this would not be a taxable transaction. If it is a taxable transaction,
it's not worth
no
doing.
Sense yeah. at all, because shareholders wind up having to pay a massive tax bill on the spin-off.
See.
And so now they've now started pondering, and this is my favorite thing of all, they've started pondering, well, what if we do it the other way around? And instead of spinning off the Alibaba shares to Yahoo shareholders, what happens if we spin off Yahoo
right.
to Yahoo shareholders? Which is the most wonderful...
Like, yes.
First of all, how would that work? And second of all, why would the IRS be okay with that?
It's not a repatriation of foreign funds, right? That's the difference. I mean, I'm sure there would be tax consequences, but I don't think it would be.
So that's actually an incredibly good question, Kathy. Basically, the Yahoo board is flailing. They brought in this extremely glamorous and expensive CEO.
Who
just had twins. Congratulations, Marissa. And she basically did nothing to the core business. It's managed to go absolutely nowhere since she came in. She's had massive executive turnover, and the core business has basically gone nowhere. But the share price has gone up because Alibaba went public.
And they hired Katie Couric. Can't say she did nothing.
And they hired Martha Nelson at a salary of $5 million
right.
a year.
Which and is, Andy Serwer, for that matter. But anyway.
Do you think he's getting paid $5 million
no,
a year?
No, I do not.
No.
So actually, my theory about this like valuation thing is if Yahoo is – it totally makes sense from my perspective if Yahoo is like a shareholder in Alibaba and otherwise just loses money like hell. Then it makes sense that it's overall worth less than –
But I don't think it loses
it's
money.
It stakes.
Yeah.
But it's just not valued at a positive. Like if
it does lose money, I'm just
okay.
Saying,
so this
right?
is the idea that the board is now entertaining the idea that they could sell the what's known as the internet business of mm-hmm. Yahoo, which is basically everything that you've heard of. And if you put it up to the highest bidder, then there are people who would bid billions of dollars for it. How many billions? We don't know. It might be one. It might be two. It might be five. But Yahoo as a business is actually worth something.
Okay.
It's not. It only looks worthless if you consider the Alibaba stake and the Yahoo Japan stake, if you value them fully. But there's no particular reason why you should value them fully, because you can't really extract them from the company without paying taxes.
Okay. Maybe that's just the difference, right? Well, I don't know how this all works. It seems pretty approximate to me, actually. The breaking up, the valuation of companies.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the valuation of the valuation of companies is not approximate at all. It's exactly the share price multiplied by the number of shares, and that's a very exact number which changes second to second. But how investors determine what's a sensible price, that's on a short-term level, it's pretty random. It's just a random walk. And on the long term, you know, share prices fluctuate, and there's a bunch of assumptions built into them which you can argue with.
I think one of the big problems with Yahoo as a company, and it was something that Marissa was supposed to figure out and didn't figure out, is they haven't really made the transition to mobile. A very large share of that massive audience that you talk about for their properties is desktop. And, of course, desktop is still very valuable, but all the motion from other companies is toward mobile. And then, yeah, even within the internet business itself, there are all these kind of parts lying around that nobody knows what to do with. And you know, like Google, they're often in the position of buying companies and then just kind of letting them die. I have a great name for you, a great trivia name from approximately 10 years ago. Brad Garlinghouse.
Ooh,
do you remember? Do you remember the Peanut Butter Manifesto of 2006? Brad Garlinghouse was like a VP of something at Yahoo, and he wrote this thing called the Peanut Butter Manifesto.
This is coming back to me.
In which he talked about the company as being like peanut butter, like spreading it really thin to the outskirts of the piece of bread, and that you're not going to grow this company by spreading it a little further. It's like we got to figure out what it is that we do that's at the core of the sandwich and concentrate it on that rather than trying to keep pushing out the. And they still, this is 10 years ago, and they still haven't figured it out. That, I think, is
great to have Jim on the show. I really like him.
Aw.
Next week on Slate Money,
let's talk about
Jim Ledbetter.
I feel like
Jim is just going to, take over the world.
It's a beautiful metaphor.
It is a beautiful metaphor.
It is a beautiful metaphor.
Enduring. And then I remember when there was the talk of merging Yahoo with Microsoft, I wrote a blog post saying, you don't solve a peanut butter problem by putting jelly on top of it.
But you do. I love peanut butter and jelly.
I do too, but...
Okay. Enough, Yahoo. Slate Money is also sponsored by ZipRecruiter. I feel that Marissa Mayer should be using ZipRecruiter to hire senior executives because she can't possibly do worse than she's been doing up until now. And ZipRecruiter has a gazillion candidates. Well, again, that's maybe a small exaggeration. It has over 6 million resumes on file. If you post a job ad using ZipRecruiter, as more than 400,000 businesses have done, they will find you the perfect candidate almost immediately, certainly within 24 hours. It's so much easier than trying to go to a million different job sites and post it all over the place. It's a one-stop, simple solution, and it has a 100% satisfaction guarantee. They will fix everything if you don't love it. So try ZipRecruiter for free today by going to ZipRecruiter.com/SlateMoney. That's ZipRecruiter.com/SlateMoney to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/SlateMoney. Jim Ledbetter, for the third and final merger of the week that we're going to talk about. Oh, yeah. So I've decided we're not going to talk about Staples and Office Depot because they're not merging.
Right, because there are antitrust concerns, actually.
And so, but if Staples and Office Depot aren't allowed to merge, how on earth could this one happen?
Yeah, so this one is, of course, Dow Chemical and DuPont, two of the largest chemical companies in the world. And the merger of them, which would create a company of approximately $92 billion in annual sales, would in fact be the largest chemical company in the world, taking over the current market leader, which is BASF, a German chemical concern.
And where's Monsanto in that list?
It seems to me that, because I looked at that this morning with the same question in mind, Monsanto, I think, is categorized differently as an agriculture company. Most of the world's largest chemical companies are very closely related to oil companies, whereas Monsanto is strictly speaking an agricultural chemical conglomerate. I think that's the answer.
I see.
So that
but it's also huge, right?
It's very large. And there are agricultural divisions of both DuPont and Dow Chemical, and that seems to be part of what is at the heart of this merger. So a few things about this. One is that even though it's creating a company with $92 billion in annual sales, this is not the largest merger of 2015. It's not even in the top three because this is or will end up being the largest year for mergers and acquisitions in American history.
So what are the top three?
The top three are, give me one moment here.
I just want to say for the record that Jim came prepared.
I am prepared.
Wow.
The top three, one of them was Dell ADP. One of them is Pfizer Allergan. McGann.
Oh,
and then,
right.
And then, of course, Anheuser-Busch InBev S.A.B. Miller.
Was that 2015?
About. Yeah.
Oh, but not, wait, S.A.B. Miller and Pfizer Allergan and Dow DuPont. The one thing which all of these...
I said Dell EMC. I'm sorry, I got the name of that.
The one thing which all of these deals have in common is that none of them have actually closed.
That's right.
They're all going up in front of antitrust regulators, and the regulators can all say no.
So these are announcements of intended merger.
Typically, though, I mean, there are of course exceptions, but usually what happens is they'll have to sell off this or that. I doubt these mergers will be rejected altogether. It could happen.
Although Pfizer Allergan, that's like, you know, every single politician in America is railing against that one.
And that always works.
It's because of the inversions?
Because it's an inversion, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because the idea is that Pfizer, which is a big company, is getting bought by Allergan, which is a smaller company, which just by coincidence happens to be headquartered in Ireland.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So
is anything like that happening with DuPont and Dow?
We are looking at $4.5 trillion worth of mergers. Adjusted for inflation, 2007 probably edges it out. But at any rate, 2015 comes very, very close to being the biggest mergers and acquisition year.
Why
of
is
time.
That, Jim?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Part of it clearly has to do with the durable availability of cheap money.
We've had cheap money for many years,
yeah,
right?
Here's the chart. It's going
here's
up.
Here's the chart.
Yeah, it's going up.
Jim is pointing at a chart
imagine,
here, which goes
imagine a chart
up
that goes up.
The
imagine,
right.
Yes, imagine a kind of hockey stick growth from left to right. The trough of which, of course, is the
so I have
of
I have a kind of theory about this, which is, you know, that the Fed has been dumping money out of helicopters for many years now,
and onto
the first effect of that is for stock prices to go up and for bond prices to go up. And once the stock prices and the bond prices have gone up about as far as you think they can possibly go, then the effect of all of this liquidity, it just starts swirling around. And what happens when liquidity swirls around is that you get mega mergers.
Art purchases.
And that really what happens in a mega merger is not that anything changes
right.
most of the time. It's change of ownership. It's just different people and owning that, different combinations of stuff.
But in this case, it's actually their competitors.
They are competitors. And here's the thing. Both of these companies within the last few months have been the target of well-known activist investors. In the case of DuPont, Nelson Peltz. In the case of Dow Chemical, Daniel Loeb. And in both cases, what the activist investors were trying to do, which is what activist investors usually do, back to your point about valuations, is get enough of the company to own it, to split it up, to spin off the value. And that's actually what's going to happen. So they're going to come together to be very large and then split off into three parts.
So this is the thing I really love about this deal. And this is why one of the reasons I really wanted to talk about it is because normally when you get to $60 billion companies merging to become a $120 billion company, everyone goes, ooh, wow, that's huge.
Huge. Now let's make it smaller.
In this case, you have two $60 billion companies merging to become three $40 billion companies.
Right, right.
Which is kind
imagine
of...
imagine the growth possibilities.
But the crazy thing is that each of those $40 billion companies is going to have more monopoly power than either of the $60 billion companies do right now. Because basically, both of the $60 billion companies have three main business lines. It's agriculture. What are they, Jim?
Oh, agriculture, products, materials like plastics and so-called specialty products. Those will be the three divisions.
And so they're both competing with each other on three fronts. And then what you do is you merge the two together, you split it up into three companies, and then those three companies don't compete with each other at all.
So in three different industries, they're being anti-competitive.
Yes.
And look, you know...
That is quite a feat.
Price fixing and other anti-competitive behavior is rife within this industry and has been for decades. They made a movie about it. If you remember The Informant
with Matt Damon
based on the – that one was Archer Daniels Midland, closer to the Monsanto kind of agriculture things. But the price-fixing allegations had been made by this guy that is played by Matt Damon named Mark Whitaker, if memory serves. And so we sort of take it as a given that there's a lot of kind of nodding and winking going on in this sector. But here's the other interesting thing. When you play – on this level, when you are selling chemicals by the tens of billions of dollars a year, your chief competition is actually state-run enterprises outside of the United States. I suspect most Americans do not know these companies, but after BASF and Dow Chemical, the third largest chemical producer is Sinopec, part of the Chinese government. And then the next one after that is, I think it's SABIC. It's Saudi Arabia's chemical company. Now, presumably, state-owned enterprises do not go through this exercise of merging in order to spin off. And yet, that's what our companies need to do to compete with state-run enterprises. I find it very strange. But I was sort of struck by
that. Yeah, and state-run enterprises are fascinating. And some of them are, highly efficient, and some of them are highly inefficient. And and some of them can change. Like, for instance, PDVSA, which is the Venezuelan oil company, used to be, not that long ago, maybe 10 years ago, certainly 15 years ago, one of the most efficient and advanced oil companies in the world. It was an incredibly professionally run operation.
I think Chavez took care of that.
And then Hugo Chavez comes in and basically fires everyone who's in charge of it and replaces them with a bunch of, like, army buddies of his. And now PDVSA is I believe the technical term is, a shit show.
So, I mean, it brings up the question, like, how international are these companies?
Very.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean,
so they really are competing with Saudi Arabia and China.
Yeah, and Germany, which is why I suspect the antitrust concerns, while of course they should be investigated, will probably not put a stop to this merger, because there is a relatively robust global marketplace. The demand for these chemicals is clearly global.
How much lobbying money do these companies spend?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm sure it's in the millions of dollars, because they're highly regulated industries.
Yeah. Scary.
Okay, so we are going to move on to the numbers round.
Yay!
But first, Slate Money is also brought to you by The Message, which is an original science fiction podcast which Panoply has put together with GE Podcast Theater.
Hi, Nikki Tomlin here, and I'm the host of The Message. I'm going to take you into an elite cryptography think tank and check it out. Their top project right now is to decode a highly classified radio transmission from the 1940s.
Have you listened to it yet?
Not yet. We're having a discussion about that. But if I offered you the chance to listen to it right now... Sounds like a no.
Well, we don't really know what it is. Voices, music, breathing. But, you know, I'm not going to mess with that thing.
To sum it up, extraterrestrials. Subscribe to The Message on iTunes.
Numbers.
I have an awesome.
So Jim has told us, like,
he's really
twice now
he's
that he's
oversold
really,
it.
Really into
yeah, you're probably
number.
Right. I have oversold it, but I'm so excited by this number. It's not the number per se. I just think this topic is one of those ones that makes me thwack my head. The number is $1.3 million. That is the number this week that a fine that was levied by the Federal Trade Commission against Nordstrom, Bed Bath & Beyond, JCPenney, and an online retailer called Backcountry.com. $1.3 million divvied up among the four because the FTC accuses them of passing off rayon as bamboo in a variety of products, some of which are bed linens for babies and sort of all this stuff. And this is the reason the FTC is so pissed is that they had deliberately warned retailers in 2010 not to do this. But apparently people are so bamboozled by the idea of bamboo that they can't help it. The funny thing being, you know, rayon sounds very kind of like space age, artificial, chemically. It really is a kind of reconstituted cellulose. You can do things to bamboo that make it essentially rayon, and kind of almost vice versa. There's very little difference. And obviously, consumers like what they're buying.
Right.
You know, they think it's bamboo. They're happy with it. They're not taking it back, saying, you know, get rid of this rayon out of my house. So if it, the problem here is that people seem to be too in love with the idea of products made from bamboo.
The problem here is that people don't understand There's this distinction between natural and artificial, between chemicals on the one hand and natural things on the other hand. People like bamboo because it grows out of the ground and it's natural.
Right. And it grows quickly.
And pandas eat it.
There's good things about bamboo, actually.
Yeah, yeah. But the fact is that chemically speaking, it's really not that dissimilar from rayon.
Right. Once you make it into a sheet... It's panda charming qualities have been ironed
false,
out of it.
False advertising.
It is false advertising. I'm not trying to defend the retailers as much as the retailers have created this problem in a sense, or the marketers have created this problem by making people fall in love with bamboo when obviously rayon does just as well. They should just learn to like make people like rayon.
They should rename rayon.
Yeah, rayon needs a
bamboo
needs a
with
brand
three
makeover.
O's or
yeah.
something.
Well, you see, rayon was named like I think around the same time as nylon, back when like chemicals were cool,
cool.
And
exactly.
Now chemicals are uncool.
Exactly. Make chemicals cool again, and you won't
make
have
chemicals
to pay
cool
the
again.
$1.3 million.
And in the meantime,
Kathy is doing her bit for making chemicals.
I did forget
again.
To mention how environmentally horrible the K cups are, so I'll just throw that in right now.
Oh, good.
Let's fix that as well.
Leave the bamboo to the pandas. We'll make our sheets out of rayon.
So my number is $100 million, and it's. It was actually already mentioned. I was a little bit worried that you guys would go so far as to mention my number before it was time. But it's the price that Alibaba is paying
For the South China Morning
Post.
Oh,
yeah.
Is that the actual number?
Well, that's an estimate. But
I think it's like $100 or $200 million, something around there. The South China Morning Post is what 112 years old. This venerable paper.
It's pretty old, and it's won a lot of awards, and it's in English. It's printed in Hong Kong. And
do we know the circ? Do we know how big it is?
It's got 100,000 print circulation.
It's pretty small.
It's pretty small, but it's influential.
Yeah,
and
I read it.
So the Alibaba, which is like the China Amazon, right? Those guys over there, they both want to influence how English-speaking newspapers talk about China.
Right.
And they claim that they're going to leave editorial independence to the South China Post, so Morning Post. So it's kind of interesting.
This is, I mean, so on the one hand, you can spin this as the end of freedom of expression in Hong Kong, which was always this little island of, you know, freedom of expression in China. But on the other hand, I don't think there has actually been freedom of expression in Hong Kong for a while.
But it just might be gradually going away, even any, you know, vestige of it.
There wasn't very much anyway, and now there's even less.
Yeah, let's put it that way.
And I feel honor-bound to do this. I kind of didn't want to, but because Jordan's not here, I need to step in.
Oh, that's
in.
So sweet.
And
I know what it is.
And so, yeah, we're just going to say that his best friend, Martin Shkreli... Mm-hmm. From Hunter High School, went and bought Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, the Wu-Tang's album for $2 million, because it's the only copy of the album. And this is much less than the Wu-Tang originally wanted to sell it for, but it is still, my colleague Kelsey at Fusion did the back of the envelope sums on this one, it is still significantly more than they could reasonably have hoped to get by just releasing it.
Is that right? $2 million?
Yeah.
Is that really true? A famous rock group can't get $2 million for an album?
Well...
What is the world coming to?
I mean, they're only going to get a percentage of sales, right? So you'd probably have to sell, like, I don't know, 10 million or 5 million to get 2 million.
Their last album, they only sold 60,000.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. They're a little past their prime. There too, was a group that was the more than the sum of its parts. I think Old Dirty Bastard alone was probably worth more than Wu-Tang.
Do you think Jordan is crying into his McDonald's coffee right now?
Well, I think Jordan is trying to come to terms with the idea that if he ever wants to listen to this album, he's going to have to hang out with Martin Shkreli. And Martin Shkreli was on the record saying, yeah, I haven't actually got around to listening to it yet, but if Taylor Swift wants to come around and listen to it, then I will.
Oh, my God.
He really is the worst human being. I will just end this podcast by saying the official motto of Slate Money is cash rules everything around me. On which note, we are going to bring this discursive episode of Slate Money to a close. A massive, huge thanks to the one and only Jim Ledbetter for coming in, for being amazing. And so, yeah, subscribe to his podcast, Ink Uncensored.
Thank you, Felix.
Because if you just read his magazine, Ink, then there's censorship going on. But for the podcast, there's no censorship.
That's
so
right.
Listen to the podcast. Many thanks to Zach Dinerstein and Andy Bowers and Steve Lickteig as the new executive producer of Panoply. So we have to thank him. He was deeply involved in this podcast. Not, but he will be.
Blame him. Blame him. Yeah.
All of the rest of Panoply's podcasts can be found at itunes.com/Panoply. And we'll talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.